You're listening to A Word in Your Ear with Professor Rolly Sussex, a podcast from ABC Radio Brisbane. For more information, head to abc.net.au/Brisbane.
Something very special for you today as we have a word in your ear with Professor Rolly Sussex. We've been joined by one of your favourites from the ABC's Gardening Australia series, Jerry Colby-Williams. Hello.
Hello.
And hello, Rolly.
Good afternoon.
Now, this is something we're going to be doing during the year, isn't it? We're going to ask experts in their fields to come in and tell us a bit more about the language surrounding whatever that field of expertise is. And Jerry, you were the first name that sprung to mind for me for this because I love watching you on Gardening Australia. I'm a terrible gardener myself, but I love watching others do it.
Well, you're my ideal customer, aren't you?
Yeah, I am, really.
You're not that good. Repeat custom, that's what keeps business going. And, of course, somebody that watches that show is somebody that's got an inquiring mind because no matter how softly we try and educate people, we're trying to make a better gardener out of you. And only keen people really tend to stick with that show.
Mm. All right. How's your garden looking at the moment,
Rolly? Well, I've got 2.5 acres, of which the horse has 2/3 and I have 1/3. Mm-hmm. And there is a trading relation of feed in one direction and manure in the other. And the manure is great for the tomatoes. So we live in equity, and it's
just the way it should be.
It works pretty well, yes.
In harmony.
But things have been a bit dry recently until sort of the rain's been irregular, and so I've been out there with buckets and things.
Yeah, doing what you have to do.
But Queensland gardening is so much fun because there are so many things you can grow, which when I was in Melbourne were difficult. On the other hand, roses I struggle with.
Should we even bother with roses, Jerry?
Yes, you should. The roses that like the heat are generally those that have China rose blood in them, mm-hmm. which is a subtropical rose. So they don't tend to get the major diseases that most roses get. And only last week I was at the Perennial Poppies, which is probably Queensland's most successful gardening club. Mm-hmm. And there was a show and tell, and there was a whole festival of gorgeous perfect roses coming by.
Nice.
And they all had that China rose blood. So you're thinking of tea roses, not the hybrid teas, the old tea roses, noisette roses. They're classics. But overall, they are the ones which have very small flowers, but lots of them.
Mm. I've got a thing called a Sussex rose.
Yes.
Which is doing brilliantly and is galloping away, whereas I tend the icebergs carefully and it does nothing at all.
Well, icebergs should be a little bit more giving to you, I should admit. I was always shocked when I came over here that Australians grow far better iceberg roses than they can be grown in England where they actually originated. Mm. I mean, I was happy if I got 2 crops of flowers from them. When I grew them in the rose garden in Sydney Botanic Gardens, they flowered recurrently all year round, and we actually had to prune them while they were flowering, and they were bleeding while we were pruning them. So that was a real education in rose culture.
Yeah.
All right. The language that a person uses, Jerry, when they describe a plant or a problem with their garden, does that let you know about their level of understanding?
Yes. Yes, it does. It also reveals a little bit about me as well, because sometimes if we don't share that common language of describing a plant or a problem, then I may jump to something which is a little bit more advanced than perhaps I should. Mm-hmm. And there was one occasion where somebody was describing oxalis in their garden, and I just had no idea what it was that they were describing. And so I asked them to send in photos. And in these days of social media, it makes identifying problems much easier. But that shared language isn't always there. And a classic was when I was running a garden centre in London, and somebody came up to me and they said, "Have you got that plant that goes up and falls down?" That's right. And so we
had palm tree?
It wasn't like talk back, so we had time to discuss this. And what it turned out to be was a dwarf standard grafted weeping willow. So it has a tall stem, so it goes up, and then it's a weeping willow, which hangs down. So it goes up and hangs down.
That's beautiful. Unlike oxalis. How you got to that answer, I have no idea.
Unlike oxalis, which comes from Greek and the word means sour. And apparently if you chew oxalis, it tastes bad.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Well, those would be the oxalates inside it. So yeah. they're not very good for your kidneys if you feed yourself on it too much.
Doing it, yeah.
Yes, yes. Keep guinea pigs away, and horses certainly wouldn't want too much of it in their diet either.
Mm.
We have a caller already. Andrew at Fernie Hills. Hello.
Hello, Kerry.
What's your question for Jerry?
For Jerry and Rowley, I want to know why, as far as the scientific names, we call the bottle brush a callistemon, yet we pronounce the golden panda as xanthostemon. Why isn't it callistemon or xanthostemon?
Well, the names have a relationship to what the plant is about. Generally, it's a description of the flowers. So the way I come in on this, when I was in England, we would actually pronounce callistemon callistemon. So that's an English pronunciation of a scientific name. But callistemon really means showy stamens. Mm. So one of the most important aspects of a bottle brush are these amazingly showy stamens with their golden pollen on top. And so that's been used to describe the genus.
Mm. Kalos is Greek for beautiful, and as in calligraphy is beautiful writing. And the stamen, but it's just a stamen.
Mm.
Yeah. But getting the stresses in the right place, you know, callistemon and callistemon, I've virtually only heard callistemon in Australia. And yet I don't think the dictionary lists it at all.
Right.
Yet most people, well, as far as the golden panda, they call it xanthostemon instead of xanthostemon.
Mm.
Yes, yes. Well, this is true. And I must say that one of the things I'm fairly militant about is the way in which scientific names are pronounced. I'm not going to correct somebody if they call a camellia and not a camellia. It doesn't matter. If they can remember what the scientific name is and how to spell it, that's all I care about. And I use the scientific names in preference to the common names, because if you can get hold of that name or just write it down, don't even remember it, just write it down, then what you have is a key for information. You insert that into a website search or into a library search, and you will retrieve information which is relevant to you. If you use a common name, well, it's hit and miss. You may find out something, you may not, because a common name really only means something to a person in a particular culture, in a particular place, and at a particular time. And that's too hit and miss when you're talking about something like horticulture.
Mm. Like billy goat weed is ageratum, I think, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. And you know, what is ageratum to a horticulturalist? You know, billy goat weed may be quite local. And other things which confuse me, when I came up to Queensland, couch in my lawn in Melbourne was terrible, and we'd dig it out. And couch up here is regarded as being quite favourable, and it survives. It's a better sort of grass. But that leads us to the relativity of weeds, which I love.
Well, what is the definition of a weed?
Well, I think the only definition that really stands up to scrutiny is a plant that is growing in the wrong place.
The one you don't like.
You know, there's a great irony in this. If you look at something like radiata pine, for example, really common forest tree, and it is weedy. So bush regenerators don't like it. The forestry department love it because it's very easy to grow and widely grown. But in fact, this weed, this potential weed, is endangered in its natural habitat. It is a rare plant. Its habitat has been built out in California because it sits between where people want to live and a beautiful ocean view. So it's been built out. So what is a weed in Australia is actually a conserved threatened plant in its natural environment.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah. Like Salvation Jane and Patterson's Curse, right?
Now, that's another great example of how people can have two different perceptions of the same weed.
Mm.
I don't think anybody would disagree that that particular plant, that echium plant, is not a weed. It was introduced as an ornamental, and it does so well, it can colour the landscapes to the point that people buying picture postcards of Australia will think that it's actually native. But it's a horrible, horrible weed. But when things are really, really dire, then it's one of the few things that is possible for sheep to browse on. And so that weed which excludes the decent pasture in the good times can actually be one of the few things that will keep your sheep from dying in bad times. So it becomes Salvation Jane.
So as you said before, it depends on who is using it in what context, about what topic, and
And as you know, if you get a room of 20 gardeners together, they'll all know the right answer and they'll not change for anything.
Jerry, you were talking about the importance of people, the importance of people knowing the scientific names of plants. When did that become important for you? Like at what stage of your experience as a gardener and as a professional?
I was just talking to Rowley about this before we came in, and it was when I became a student at Kew Gardens, and that's when it became really serious, because there were only two things they could kick you off the course for. One was not being able to recognise a plant. So plant recognition, that was a key, and management. You fail any of those things just once and you're gone, your history.
Just once?
Yeah, and I skipped my two plant ident tests that I could skip. You had 22 in a year and you had to do 20 and you had to pass all of them. I skipped the two, so I had to do the dreaded Australian plants ident.
And why is it dreaded?
Because if you're not from Australia, the diversity, the peculiarities of the plants are quite difficult to just cram your head with knowledge. You can't just walk in to a slice of Australia and be able to identify things with a European background. There's so many dissimilarities. So I had to get it right and I had to learn the scientific names, and I was well behind all the other students. I was 5 years younger than all the other students, and I was just a craft gardener. So they told me I had to learn one scientific name every single day, which is quite digestible. And I just started doing it and it became a habit. So that was when I realised I had to do it. It was for survival. But in this role, when we're talking now, and in my work through Gardening Australia and all sorts of other aspects of my life, using the scientific name is giving somebody a key to information. And it's very important that you give people that, because I don't want people to be dependent on me. I want them to become independent and make myself redundant.
Yeah. What does the scientific name, what information does it tell someone?
Well, it'll tell you a little bit about the plant, as we were talking about calostemon, that it tells you a little bit about the plant. If it is really easy to understand, it may tell you about its environment that it likes, about its cultural habitat, where it comes from, geographic distribution. So it's lots of little clues in there.
Like Japonica, for example.
Yes, they are. And then there are other things which can be really awful, like Drummondii. The botanist explorer Drummond, widely collected in Western Australia in the early days. And he was shocking at keeping records where he found it. He could be thousands of kilometres out in some of his records. And he named everything after himself. So when you use a name like Acacia Drummondii, well, that's not so bad. But when you start looking at the list of plants that he named after himself, they tell you nothing. They tell you nothing. And I actually had some friends in Western Australia, retired farmers, dear friends, that used to spend their quiet times exploring, following Drummond's footpath, trying to actually find things that he described once that were never ever found again, because his information was so erratic.
It's not what you're after.
Well, but this is eponyms again. Eponyms are things which are named after a person, and and botany must be full of them. You know, like dahlias and fuchsias. And
absolutely.
And I named this plant after me.
Yes. Or my aunt.
Yeah. Oh. Is there a Colibia somewhere?
No, but there's quite a few things with Vera after it.
Yeah. ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland with Kelly Higgins Devine this afternoon, joined by ABC Gardening Australia's Gerry Colby-Williams and Professor Rolly Sussex. We're having a word in your ear on gardening this afternoon. So if you have a question relating to the language of gardening, maybe you're a gardener, you've always wondered about a particular plant, give us a call this afternoon, 1300 222 612. It might be a pronunciation where you've seen a particular plant, you thought, does it belong here? There are all sorts of questions you can throw to Gerry and Rolly this afternoon. 1300 222 612, SMS 0467 922 612, or you can tweet at ABC Brisbane. We've got Paul at Nambour on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you going?
Excellent. That's What's your question for the gentleman?
I say foliage. Everybody else says foliage. What is it?
What do you say, Gerry?
Well, I speak English, and so that's a bit of a limitation when you come over to Australia, because we have so many different cultures here. There's New Zealand English, Australian English, Irish English, Scottish English, all these sort of things all mixed up, and quite a lot of American English. So I actually meet people that often say foliage.
Foliage.
Which freaks me out. It's like hearing Americans talk about herbs, you know. I mean, American English is, well, you know, it's a bit like Afrikaans is being baby Dutch. So, look.
Oh, I can hear the guns it pointing. Is,
yep, it's all right.
Well, you know, it's just one of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
But foliage is the way that I would pronounce it. Would you disagree?
I think I'd say foliage. I think. But I've heard and seen both. Foliage is definitely common, but I think people have got the letters round the wrong way for some reason.
Yes.
And it's quite confusing. So foliage is I think, probably the most common.
Foliage is the most common. Is it? Is it correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Surely.
There we go.
The foliage isn't good enough.
Foliage not good enough, Rolly?
Well, foliage, the Oxford Dictionary says foliage. With two, foliage, right? But foliage, no. Avoid foliage. Foliage at all costs.
Okay, we shall do. I just wanted to talk to you about some of these modern concepts of gardening, Gerry. You talk about tribes, that we have gardeners are tribal. In what way are they tribal?
Well, everybody belongs to a particular group. And although they may not realize, that tends to define their attitudes. So if you are talking to a group of people, and it's not a particular society, it's just a group of people, say at a gardening expo, you'll have the widest range of gardening tribes there. So I try and press buttons in all different corners. But essentially, there are two major ways of approaching horticulture. And one is the individualist. My garden, my fence, my tree. And you can talk to, say, give a lecture about environmentally responsible horticulture, which tends to be my pitch. And at the end of it, an individualist will come up to you and say, it was a lovely talk. Now, about my lemon tree, why are the leaves yellow? That's an individualist. And they are able to make decisions on their own. A wheat farmer would be another example of somebody that can make a decision within their fence line without necessarily referring to their neighbours. They're quite powerful as individuals, and they will have a league table where there's a winner at the top and a loser at the bottom, and they know which way they want to head. But then there's the other group, and I suppose if I've talked about wheat, I should talk about rice growing, because that's the first one, the individualist, is the Western way of thinking, and that's often described as weird. Western, educated, industrialized, rich and developed. But on the other side, you might be talking about a rice farmer, which is an Eastern way of thinking. Now, when you look at a traditional series of rice paddies, they are interlinked. The water levels have to be timed. The water has to be drained. The water has to be entering the paddies at just the right time. There's a right time for cooperative maintenance of these systems. So people tend to think in terms of community and cooperation with neighbours. Mm. So it's us, we, together, team. Those sorts of things come in. And that's quite clearly when you're talking to organic gardeners, they'll have a sense of the environment. They'll have a sense of animal rights in there. If you're talking to permaculturists, the community will be in pretty much every conversation that you have with them. And they're totally different. So it's a good idea to press lots of different buttons if you've got a mixed group, but it's much easier if you can focus in on that group and communicate clearly with their core objectives.
That's fascinating because I work on intercultural communication, and there one of the major divisions is between collectivist Eastern, and it's a terrible generalisation, but never mind, cultures and individualistic Western ones. And we celebrate the individual, and it's the rights of the individual which are important. Whereas ever since Confucius, about the 6th century BC, I think, what is important is the feeling for the other people in your group and working with them collaboratively. And I hadn't thought about rice and wheat as being an example of cultural things at work, but it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
And the language, obviously important as well to both of those groups, how they describe themselves and what they do.
Absolutely. And I never really worked it out until I was a student at Kew. Mm-hmm. Mm. And there at Kew, they managed to combine both Eastern and Western thinking. Yeah. So when you approach a complicated landscape, like a botanic garden, you have a whole of site management approach. So you look at teams, collective management, making sure the same principles are applied widely. Mm. And yet they want to be the best botanic garden. They want to have achievements. They want to be right at the top of the scoreboard. Mm. And they manage to do that as well. So they both play both fields.
Botanic and botanical. There's one botanical in Australia, I think in Hobart or something.
That's it, the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens.
That's right.
And I keep getting told that botanical is the best way to describe what I would call a botanic garden.
Kew is botanic, I think.
Yes, Kew is botanic, and so I always lean on the alma mater when people are arguing about these things. And it's never really been explained to me that one has precedence over the other.
All right, so are they interchangeable?
They are in conversation, but if you were to use it in the wrong garden, like the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens, then you might be corrected.
Okay. Yeah.
And economic and economical are a little bit different.
This
and
is
economical
true.
Can mean taking care of your pennies, whereas economic is just relating to economy. Botanic and botanical, I think, mean the same thing, but there's a convention about which is appropriate in the right place. And why Hobart went the other way, I have no idea.
Well, they were the first place to be gardened in the Western sense in Australia, so I guess they have the chance
of
the precedent. Yes.
So they had the right to choose, in a sense.
In a way.
Yeah.
We'll take some calls in just a moment on ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland. Jerry Colby-Williams joining us with Rolly Sussex this afternoon. We're having a word in your ear about gardening. Some great questions coming up about eucalypts being renamed. Professor Rolly Sussex having a word in your ear as we do every Thursday, joined this afternoon by ABC Gardening Australia's Jerry Colby-Williams. Now let's go to Ron from, I think he's from the Palms. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, g'day, Kelly.
What's your question?
I've got a question for Jerry. I have a number of large Corymbia maculatas on my block, or spotted gums, and I understand they were renamed from eucalypt to Corymbia because of the inflorescence of the flower, but what I don't know is who came up with the bright idea.
Well, Ron, I actually worked with two of the people most responsible for that, and Laurie Johnson, who was a former director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney, and he was the major mover and shaker, and then Don Blaxall, who was my assistant director for about 6 years. And the reason they rename these. And the reason why there's an enormous amount of the renaming of plants going across the world at the moment is because of DNA analysis. That's really what it's about.
Okay. Now,
on the one hand, this is wonderful because it's completely transforming our understanding of the natural relationships, the evolutionary relationships between plants. So, for example, things like lotus and London plane trees are actually closer together than a lotus is to other water lilies. And this whole thing is totally ridiculous to an average gardener like myself. But it does help us understand how plants evolved through a thing called a clade. And it's this evolving understanding of which clade plants belong to, which is really quite fascinating. However, in reality, DNA analysis doesn't allow you to produce, say, a book where you can key out different species which used to be in the genus Eucalyptus as easily as you once did. In the past, it was the shape of the gum nut, the description of the flowers and the positioning and the size of the leaves, that sort of thing. And they're physical things that you can see in the field and you can compare and slowly work your way through a list and say, it's not this one, this is what it is. You can't do that with some of the ways that they've separated the eucalyptus from Corymbia. And they did actually, when I was working at Mount Annan Botanic Gardens in 1986, we planted the eucalyptus group in the arboretum, and there was other genera like Symphia myrtus, which we planted, and that's now been abandoned and reincorporated in the genus Eucalyptus to make it easier. But for an average person, a key is really what you need to tell tree A from tree B, and DNA analysis isn't helping us in that sense.
Mm. Eucalyptus, by the way, means beautifully covered. Eau and calyptus.
It has a little operculum, little cap that sits on the top of the gum fruit or the gum flower.
That's right.
Beautiful. So will we find that there will be many species that may be renamed because of DNA analysis?
Kelly, it's happening all the time. And it's now got to the point when I do a post or write anything, I double check before I put it out there, because even outside this studio, you have some pink flowering trees, which up until a few years ago were called Tababuya. And it would be really nice if people could pronounce the name Tababuya. Mm. Now it's Handroanthus.
What?
And what happened?
They split Tababuya. So there's Handroanthus and there's Tababuya. And most of the ones which we grow as flowering trees in Brisbane have fallen into the Handroanthus camp. So life is complicated.
Is jacaranda still jacaranda?
It's safe at the moment, yes.
Mm. But maybe not forever.
Maybe not forever, no.
Okay. Okay. At Gympie, while we all get used to that idea, wait a minute, oh, who have I got next? Sorry, I've got Dan. Kay, I'll be with you in a second. Dan, hello.
Hello.
You wanted to ask a question as well?
Yes, please. I was just wondering what the translation of the word brachychytum, which is the genus of plants, is to English.
Brachychytum.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you.
Brach is the Latin word for arm.
Yes.
Do you have brachychytum at home, Dan?
Yeah, I've got about 400 little baby rupestris.
So you're very much into a genus which is endemic in Australia. That's one of the things I like about the genus Brachychytum, is that they are uniquely Australian. The other thing I like about them is encouraging gardeners that want to plant a rainforest garden. I always say don't go for wet rainforest plants, go for dry rainforest plants, because they look just as rainforesty, but they need a lot less water, which is really handy.
Yep.
And brachychytum is one of those classic dry rainforest plants that adds beauty to any garden.
Yeah. Right. Actually, I've just realised brachus is Greek for short, so it's going to be short something or other. I'm going to have to think about chitin for a moment.
All right. So, well, but thank you, Dan. Good question. Yeah. That that has got Rolly thinking. Yeah. We may get back to that in this next 20 minutes. If you've just joined us, the ABC's Gardening Australia's Jerry Colby-Williams is here having a word in your ear with Professor Rolly Sussex about plants and language. Kay is at Gympie. Hi, Kay.
Hi, Cal. Hi, Rolly. Hi, Jerry. Hi. Jerry, you've probably answered my question. I adore bottle brushes, and whether they're callistemons or callistamens, I think they describe the plant very well. But at my local government-run native nursery, I couldn't find them because they had them as melaleucas. And I said, they're not melaleucas, they're callistemons. And he said, no, the name's been changed. And I said, well, it can't be changed. How can it be changed? It describes what it was.
Well, the horror continues. The horror continues for UK today to find out it could all be changed.
My favourite plant of all things. And so what does melaleuca mean that describes a bottle brush?
Well, what you hit on there, Kay, is DNA analysis has separated the two genera, which are related. They're in the Myrtaceae family, the eucalyptus family. So they haven't changed radically. They're still that in that family. But DNA analysis has shown that they're actually what we used to call a melaleuca, a paper bark, is indeed a bottle brush or callistemon.
Oh, well, I think it's an insult, but thank you for explaining it.
Well, it's
thanks, Kay.
Okay, bye-bye. I love your program. Bye.
Oh, thanks, Kay.
I think it's an inconvenient truth, and it's just the way it is. But, you know, we will reach a point where there'll be a certain amount of stability in names again once we've got through this, because, of course, it's novel technology.
Yeah, and melaleuca is interesting because the mel bit means black in Greek and the leuke means white, as in leukemia and so on. So melaleuca is literally a black-white.
And that's a reference to when the tree's bark has been burnt, so it'll be black and white.
Yes.
Yeah, which is perfect.
Yeah.
So do people who name plants revert to Greek roots as a...
No, not exclusively. This is why I tend to call these names scientific names or botanical names rather than Latin names, because it does borrow a lot from Greek, and it'll borrow all sorts of things, including people's family relatives, their names, and all that sort of thing as well. So it's a scientific name that's just not claim it by any particular culture.
Yeah. So dahlias are from... Count Dahl, I think it was.
That's right.
Yeah, and fuchsias are from Fuchs, which is the German word, which means a fox, and so on.
Oh.
Yeah. I wanted to ask Gary about CO2, which is now a terrible, bad
carbon
thing. Yeah, and yet it was once not so bad.
Well, it's interesting. You see, I'm so old that when when I was at Kew Gardens, carbon dioxide enrichment of crops was the in thing. And at that stage, so this is in the late 70s, they'd noticed that if you boost the CO2 inside a sealed environment like a glass house or an igloo, you could get plants to grow faster. What they were to discover a few years later was that the extra growth was at the expense of fibre. So things like thatch, which was used on roofs, was rotting faster than it ever used to. So the cycle of rethatching roofs had to change. And that the nutritional density of the crops that were being grown was reduced by carbon dioxide enrichment. We now know that carbon dioxide enrichment is actually reducing the nutritional value to the extent that they've actually got a figure on it, that for every degree in warming that we get, the protein content in plants decreases something like about 15%.
Whoa.
And that reason is because there is an enzyme inside plants which hook up the carbon dioxide molecules in the process of photosynthesis. And if you've got lots and lots of carbon dioxide, you need less of the Rubisco enzyme to do the work. And Rubisco is one of the sources of protein in the plants that we eat. Wow.
So you've almost saturated the plant with...
That's right. I mean, there are other things like the iron content of crops is going downhill. Mm. So that has major implications for vegetarians, like the mostly vegetarian nation of India get most of their iron through vegetable protein, produce. So I always encourage people, whether they're organic or not, to keep taking their multivitamins.
Graham from Willembar, good afternoon.
G'day Kelly, hello gents.
Your question.
Yeah, I'm growing two citrus trees in pots at home. One's a Tahitian lime and one's a native finger lime.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Tahitian lime, I can't keep up the fruit. There's that much fruit, it's, you know, there's just far too much coming off. Yet when my finger lime fruits, flowers and fruits, I'll be lucky to keep two to three fruit on.
Right, well, welcome to my world.
I
have an embarrassment of Tahitian limes, and the reason for that is that as a tree, they start to come into their best cropping at around about 9 or 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So they're constantly building up their cropping, and since my tree reached 10 years old, it's producing 6 crops a year. So it's almost continually flowering and fruiting, and this is why I'm giving away marmalade, you know.
Because, as you did to me, thank you so much.
You just have to see it. But with the finger lime, one of the things that I'm experiencing with my tree, which is the same age, 12 years old, is that the grafts that were used at the time when I bought it, so around about 2004, the grafts have a life of about 10 years. And then they start to affect the fruiting of the top stock, because almost all of the native finger limes and the Tahitian limes you'll buy are actually constructed artificial trees. So they have a top stock and a root stock, and they're grafted together at the base. And the choice of the root stock can influence the longevity of that fruiting top stock. And at 10 years, a lot of finger limes are kicking out. My one flowers beautifully and it produces 2 or 3 fruit every year reliably, but it needs to be turned over with a slightly more appropriate, more reliable rootstock.
Yeah.
Can I talk for a moment about grafts?
Please do.
Right. The question is, what is the link between a graft and inoculation?
Oh.
And the answer is that it's part of Latin. Inoculation is in and oculus. You're putting an eye in something. And when you do a graft, you make a slice and you put a bud from the other plant into it. You're putting an eye into the other one. And so that's inoculus. So the word of graft was originally taken from, grafting gave its name to inoculation, which then became a process for pharmacology. So,
that's fascinating.
So you're putting an eye in yourself when you get inoculated.
Very good.
Yeah. I want to ask also about Latin.
Yes.
Because there is a lot of Latin in your area. Things hibernate, but I've got a tree which I hope is estivating.
What is estivating?
Well, that's the summer equivalent of hibernation, where a plant or an animal becomes briefly dormant, and it's a response to the environment not being conducive for active life.
Oh, like when I just sit on the couch during summer because it's way too hot and I don't want to go anywhere or do anything, I'm actually estivating. There's a word for that.
I think it
was laziness.
It might be pseudo-estivating.
I'm using it from now on.
But look, there's a classic white fig which grows along the coasts of Queensland, and it often freaks people out around about October time when they drop their leaves. And I do every year, I'll get somebody say, I think somebody's poisoned this tree because it was nice last week and now it's dead. And it will recover, and it's just simply a response to drought in this case.
Jacarandas do that?
They do in their natural environment. And you'll find that in cities, often streetlights will cause deciduous trees to hold on to their leaves a lot longer. And sometimes you'll find, George Street in Sydney is a great place with plane trees, and you'll see these spheres of leaves around the streetlights that go into the canopies, and they'll stay all through winter. But also, jacarandas tend to need a really distinct drought to force them to drop their leaves. So it's also a response to day length and drought to get them to do it.
Okay. ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, Jerry Colby-Williams here with Professor Rolly Sussex. I'm Kelly Higgins-Devine. And with another question, Diane at Pullenvale. Hello. You there, Diane? Have I got you? No, this is Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Hi, Kelly. I just had a comment because many years ago I used to teach botany and I'd always use what was then Callistum and Viminalis, that lovely weeping red bottle brush, as a flower for students to dissect. And we were always teaching that the way to tell the difference between Melaleucas and Callistemons was in their flower and the stamens in Melaleucas. The stamens are the bit with the pollen on. They were always bundled together, and in Callistemons they weren't. And every time the students would dissect them and say, hey, this is a Callistemon, how come these stamens are bundled together? And eventually Callistemon viminalis was renamed as Melaleuca viminalis. And I think, as Jerry was talking about Drummond in Western Australia, some of the early work without the equipment and the technology we have today was sketchy. And so things do need to be renamed because they no longer fit into where they were.
Mm. Or where they should have been in the first place. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Mm.
Thanks, Diane.
I thoroughly agree with that. I mean, that really is the problem with the initial naming. And then, of course, we've got this added layer of working out where the clades actually are related to each other and which clade plants fall into. And that's the DNA analysis.
Clades are the sort of descending lines on the tree, as it were, yeah?
That's right, yeah. That's it. And it's an amazing thing to see in 3D.
Tim at Warwick, good afternoon.
G'day, Kelly, Rolly and Jerry, how are you?
Good. Very well.
Well,
my question is, you've got coriander and cilantro. Now, how can you have two totally different names for one species?
Eggplant and aubergine.
I mean, potato, tomato, but not coriander and cilantro.
Yeah. How do we get different names for the same thing, basically?
Because something is widely used in different parts of the world with different cultures, these names come about. Mm. I mean, that's really all it is. There's nothing technical about it. It's a way of communicating, and that way of communicating is very valid to the people in that particular place and culture. Mm. But it's very variable, and it's irritating sometimes to think that cilantro is actually the same thing if you've bought two packets from two different stores.
Yeah, well, the cilantro is the Spanish word, and that's come up through and is now common in America, whereas coriander comes from Latin coriandrum, and they're actually from the same root. And the LR switchover is actually quite common. But there are others. The Americans say basil rather than basil and oregano rather than oregano. And aubergine and courgette and zucchini and various other things.
And bell pepper instead of a capsicum.
Yes.
Which I used to call a sweet pepper in England.
Lots of different names for things. But thank you, Tim. Great question. And Finn from Majimba, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Kelly. How are you going?
Excellent. What's your question?
I was just wondering what the word camphor laurel actually means.
Camphor laurel.
Well, camphor laurel, I mean, it does contain camphor, which is a compound used as an insecticide to drive away moths and things from clothes. And it is in the laurel family. So camphor laurel is actually quite a reasonable common name for that particular environmental weed.
All right. Simple, gets to the
and
point.
And it's a weed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, another weed.
You can have weeds with your trees, like what was that tree that the Brisbane Council gave out about 30 years ago to grow in your garden? It's got black soot on it. Oh, this horrible thing. It'll come back to me in a moment.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, that was unfair. I take it back.
No. Trudy is at Arana Hills. Hi, Trudy.
Hello. Is that tree a beetlewood?
No, but I'll think about that one some more.
Yeah, good guess, though, Trudy.
I used to pronounce bromeliad, bromelade. What's the right way to pronounce it?
It's just straightforward, bromeliad. And, yes. And what you're saying is a really common thing out there in the gardening world. And I think it's just something that happens when your brain is thinking the word and your tongue is saying it. Because you just, I think it's just a little mental trip. Yeah. That's all it is.
Well, yes, for years I said bromelade. Hmm. So I don't know where I got that from.
Well, Trudy, sometimes I think when people mispronounce words, I read a wonderful quote not so long ago that said, you know, you should never worry too much about it or make fun of people who do, because they've probably read that word and never heard that word. Yeah. Yeah. And so you try to make sense of it without actually knowing how it's pronounced. So it's fair enough if you've never heard it. You just probably went with what it looked like.
Yep. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you. Okay. And that would happen quite a bit, wouldn't it, Jerry and Rolly? No matter whether it was gardening or not.
And again, you get shortenings like bromelo, which is quite common, or broms, just as bougainvillea becomes bogue.
Yeah.
It's actually bougainvillea is mispronounced after Bougainville, who was a French navigator. And I'm afraid his name has been bastardized as well. Poor fella.
It's got Bougainville now.
Bougainville, yeah, right. Yeah.
Indeed. Ross is at Bridgman Downs. Hi, Ross.
Hello. I used to be a fruit inspector in the market for many years, and I'm a horticulturist. And at one stage, back about 25 years ago, they changed lychee from its Latin genus name to L-Y-C-H-E-E, to me is a backward step when you've got the Latin name and the common name for many, many years, and now it's got that L-Y-C-H-E-E.
What was it called?
It was called lychee, L-I-T-C-H-I, which is the genus.
Ah, I did not know that. I've never seen that. How long ago did that happen?
Oh, 25 years ago or more.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think what you've hit on there is marketing. Because it's easier for people to read and to say. I think that's all it is. It's just something which facilitates brand recognition. Rather in the way that the word permaculture, which was invented by Mollison and Holmgren in Australia in 1978 and used to describe various permanent systems of agriculture. And now if you use that word, you know exactly what you're talking about. But it's not actually anything more than a branding.
Yeah.
Mm. I've remembered Torreliana, but I suspect that's got another name.
Kadagi. Yes, Eucalyptus
torreliana. That's right.
Which is, ironically, native to northern Queensland.
Right.
But it's an invasive weed in southeastern Queensland. It not only does it get that sooty mould problem, it also affects the quality of honey as well. Yeah.
Gentlemen, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Jerry Colby-Williams, for dropping by and helping us out this afternoon. And I look forward to the next series of Gardening Australia.
Thank you.
Indeed.
And Rolly Sussex.
I was just getting warmed up.
I know.
Can I have a final word?
Please do.
What happens when worms take over the planet?
Mm-hmm.
You get global worming.
Oh, thank you, Rolly.
You've been listening to A Word in Your Ear, a podcast from ABC Radio Brisbane. For more information, head to abc.net.au/Brisbane.